Any news for the soul? Life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. And this full hour, we are talking to Dr. David Morehouse, former CIA remote viewer. We've just come out of another intensive week-long adventure, this one called the Explorers Group, which involves experimental remote viewing targets and interesting work. We'll get into that a little bit later. But first, we're going to bring you up to date on the original story because we haven't done this on the Phoenix Station. And if you haven't heard this, you will want to hear this. You want to hear all of it. If you miss any of this show, if you're driving in a car and you got to get out for an appointment in 15 minutes, you go to the website later, newsforthesoul.com, because this story is inspiring and amazing beyond description. It's altering people, because they're going to these courses and doing remote viewing and having experiences where they not only conceptualize, no longer just sort of conceptualize or idealize the idea that we're more than the physical, but they know. And I'm talking as one of the people that have gone and had this experience now for a number of years. Let's bring him on and we'll start with the story. Welcome back, David.
Hi, Nicole. It's really great to be here. Hello, Phoenix.
It's been so long since we've talked about your original story that brought you to the place of bringing this information out into the public, out of the CIA, out of the military unit that you were in, that I think we could start at the beginning. What do you think?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so this began when for you?
Well, I was a Special Operations Ranger Company commander in 1987. I'd been 4 years with a battalion at that time, and was in my second year of company command, and my company was selected by the Department of the Army to go to the Kingdom of Jordan to train Jordanian Rangers. And during one of the training exercises there, I was wounded in the head by a stray Jordanian machine gun bullet. And during the time that I was unconscious there on the desert floor, I had a vision. And if I had had a metaphysical lexicon at the time, I guess I could have called it a phantom, a spirit, an entity, a ghost, a guide, many different things. But of course, at that juncture of my life and my career, I had no lexicon to support something like that. I had, at that juncture, spent 13 years of my life studying the art and science of taking human life. And now, suddenly I found myself being introduced to something completely juxtaposed to that. And the message that was given to me during this time that I was knocked unconscious was that I had chosen the wrong path in my life. I was to choose a new path, and it was to be a path of peace. Now, when I came to on the desert floor, certainly there are many things one could say, but I did not look at my rangers and say, boy, man, you will not believe what just happened to me. So I followed the advice of an old general friend, which was to be your own counsel, particularly in situations such as this, or similar to it, and I ended up coming back to the Ranger Battalion, and ultimately it was time for me to give up my company and rotate off to a new assignment, and I was selected to go to a special access program in Washington, D.C. And for those that don't know, a special access program is a top-secret assignment, a classified assignment, and to get into those particular assignments, one is placed through a rather extensive battery of psychological evaluation and testing, both oral and written. And that, of course, is done to establish a psychological profile on individuals that they bring in there so that they can essentially, they being the command structure of those organizations, can know what your personal envelope is and know how far they can push it.
I mean, you were 13 years pretty straight-laced, having a great time in your career and progressing forward, and everything was all normal and hunky-dory. And you were shot in the head with that.
Yeah, I was a third-generation Army officer. My father was a career officer, my grandfather was a career officer, my grandfather fought in World War One. My father fought in World War Two and in Korea, and then retired, and I was essentially just following in those footsteps. And I guess, you know, it's important to note that at this juncture, I really made a conscious decision in 1979 and even before then in being a cadet, that I really came to this conclusion that even though I didn't really want to be, in my heart of hearts, a military officer, I was really good at what I was asked to do, and I attribute that to my father, my father's training and preparation of me as to be a young officer, and not to my own individual prowess. But I made a serious mistake that many of us as human beings make, which is what we do well in life we accept as our purpose in this life, and what we do well in this life does not necessarily define our purpose. You really have to search carefully, devoid of the opinion and the interpretation of others, to be able to conclude or determine what it is right now that your purpose is. So as I came out of the desert and I turned over my company, I was recruited into this special access program. In this special access program, there was a lieutenant colonel psychologist detailed to keep his finger on the psychiatric pulse of this particular organization. And it was in one of my multiple meetings that you would have with these individuals. This, you had to sit down with this lieutenant colonel, and he would ask you about how you were doing in the unit, how were you liking it, how was your family liking it, so forth and so on. And he always had this open-ended question at the end of the hour that we shared together, which was, is there anything else you would like to share with me? And during my second assessment and evaluation with this individual, I explained to him what had happened to me in the desert, fully thinking at this particular point that probably what was going to happen was certainly not what did happen. I really wasn't clear what would occur, but I knew that I had to talk to somebody about it. I had to say, look, I had this really bizarre experience, and I'm assuming you're the guy I need to tell it to. What he ended up doing was began a process of recruiting me. He was unbeknownst to everyone else in this particular unit, which was codenamed Royal Cape. He recruited me into another top secret special access program that was codenamed at that time Sunstreak, which was this top secret clan of psychic spies called Remote Viewers. Now, that organization was housed under the Directorate of Technology and Science of the Defense Intelligence Agency, but it fell under a direct oversight responsibility to the Central Intelligence Agency. It was the CIA who actually developed the program, and the program was farmed out to various intelligence collections assets, which is where it sat, and I was now being recruited into this particular program.
So, I mean, what are you thinking at this point?
Well, I'm thinking, this is a very strange path for an airborne ranger to be walking.
I mean, you had no belief system around any of this stuff.
No, none at all. I mean, again, I had no spiritual lexicon. I had no metaphysical lexicon. I was comfortable with various belief structures that surrounded this world. But I didn't, you know, make one as my absolute understanding of this life or my existence. And it was the Army that was my religion at this point. The Army was my great wisdom, my great belief. It was everything that I put everything into, even to the point of being willing to sacrifice a relationship with my wife, or willing to sacrifice a relationship with my children, to never be present, to be deployed 10 and a half months out of every year, to be gone. And this was during peacetime in the Rangers. We would be deployed in that manner. So coming into that then, into this particular program, taking it from a very skeptical perspective, but yet then being brought through these very scientific training protocols, really beginning early on to explore the physics of the metaphysics before we ever got into anything that could be vaguely held up to smack of metaphysical. It was a very, very disciplined dogma structured protocol that each of us as trainees were brought through, which lasted in those days around 12 to 18 months, but different viewers, for example, I completed the training program in 6 months. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. It has to do with morphic resonance, 100th monkey effect from Sheldrake and Jungian psychology. But nonetheless, the more we trained people, the faster people learned it, which is why we can now train students to do it in 5 days or 7 days and get you to the same place in 5 to 7 days as it normally took the CIA to train individuals for 6 months to 12 months, and in some cases 18 months, to be considered what they called an operational remote viewer. But we should now talk about where this came from. It wasn't something that was born in some back room by some starry-eyed New Age guru. This was something that was born in a bed of science. And it was born in a bed of science circa 1972 when the director of the Central Intelligence Agency found out through various human intelligence sources that the Czechs, the Chinese, the Germans, the Israelis, the Soviets, even the British were all heavily involved in the study of various aspects of the paranormal. And once made aware of that fact, then the question was, do we have the ability? And the answer was no. Well, then why don't we have the ability? And there was no answer for that. So an endowment of some $50 million plus, and that's always debated about whether or not the researchers will give you the price tag or whether other individuals, third parties, will give you the price tag. But needless to say, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 million back in 1972 was given to Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, California, and was given to two laser physicists, Russell Targ and Harold Puthoff, and a team of physicists and researchers who were given the charge by the Central Intelligence Agency to evaluate the possibility of this human protocol, this human ability to see allegedly distant in space-time. Now, that money was spent, and 6 years were spent under laboratory conditions following strict scientific protocols, and These individuals came out 6 years later, circa 78, and said, yes, it is a viable intelligence collection methodology. Yes, it is credible. It is replicatable. We have identified the psychological profile that would allow us to train individuals to be capable of doing this. We have built a series of protocols that are replicatable, that which can be taken into virtually any arena and be trained. Individuals can be trained following these protocols. And as long as an individual has a belief that there is something more than the physical, then that individual can learn these protocols and can, in fact, see distant and space-time. So those then were brought into the military intelligence community, and that was farmed out to various enterprises, various agencies, and various other members of the military intelligence community, both Air Force, Navy, Army, what have you. And those cells began to operate, collecting one more piece of the puzzle. Not an absolute, nothing that was 100% accurate. It had its great strengths and possibility and promise, as well as its limitations. There was a great deal of interpretation that went with it. The longer viewers were trained and the longer they worked, the better they became. But as they began, when they first started out, we were rough around the edges. It was difficult for us to glean high volumes of usable data. But all of that came together throughout the years, where you had a mix of extremely well-trained and experienced viewers, and then well-trained viewers with little experience, and then, you know, viewers in the training process, gaining experience. All of those things were there, and all of these perspectives, and the volume of the data was just fantastic. And, of course, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency at that juncture was quite happy because he had one more provider of pieces of the information. It didn't have to be a black and white. It didn't have to be an all or nothing. It didn't have to achieve perfection. That certainly would have been desirable. But any time human beings are involved in the process of interpretation, there is no perfection. So it's like when you were looking at all of the other intelligence assets available, whether it was satellite imagery or human intelligence or photo intelligence or signal intelligence, electronic intelligence, all of those things in and of themselves looked independent of all of the other collection assets. None of them were 100% accurate. They could only provide their version, their interpretation from their perspective. So pulling them all together, it was the coupling of all of the information that produced the high volume, highly usable pieces of intelligence information to bring in remote viewers, recognizing that it was an imperfect process, but still it was a process that developed usable data. Then it fit nicely into the intelligence collection puzzle as very usable, a very cost-effective, a very reliable gatherer of information. Now, while I was part of that, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just to be clear for people listening who are new to this conversation, what kind of percentage of the data consistently was usable and for what kind of target?
Well, each viewer will on average produce somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 to 35% usable data. Now, that's each viewer on an average day. On good days, viewers can produce well in excess of that, 60, 70, 83% accurate data. It's difficult to provide a statistical evaluation of that. To do that, it has to be done against a quantifiable, called a calibration target, which has quantifiable or measurable attributes. In other words, you would look at something and you could say, here are 100 measurable things that we think the viewer ought to be able to gather from this calibration target or practice target, if you will. The viewer comes back with 80 things out of the 100, and certainly there will be a lot of other things that the viewer gathers which were not in the established measurable criteria but are still part of the target. And in many cases, there will be things that the viewer produces that are not even in the target gestalt, but when looked at from here's what we expected them to get and here is what they were able to gather, to sketch or to record in verbal sensory data, here are these things. Now this viewer can be deemed 80% accurate or 60 or 70 or whatever the case may be. So on average, you're producing 25 to 35%. In a collective effort, when you look at what 5 viewers will produce or 10 viewers will produce, now that statistical evaluation increases exponentially because everybody sees from a different perspective in the target area. Everybody is from a different place. There's no X on the ground where all the viewers stand and open their eyes and start looking. It's from everywhere, inside, above, down below, wherever the case may be. That then means that when you look at the data, how the data clusters and overlaps means that you're now gathering somewhere in the neighborhood from a collective effort of 60, 70, 80% of the usable target data is essentially a matter of routine. So individual viewers operating independently of other viewers have a much weaker statistical evaluation, but viewers working collectively have a highly accurate and a highly usable extraction of data from a target distance in space-time, which is why when we did, for the Sci-Fi Channel, Proof Positive, I used multiple viewers, 12 viewers. When I did the Discovery Channel story for the Ninja, where I brought in a team of 10 remote viewers, and in that team of 10 remote viewers, I actually had one viewer in Ottawa, Canada, one viewer in Zurich, Switzerland, and one of the viewers was in New York City. And I used 3 off-site viewers and the other 7 viewers I brought into a central location in Los Angeles to work that particular target. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're in Zurich, Switzerland, or whether you're 9 miles away from the target in Los Angeles. The data is still good and still usable, and the viewer is still able to do that work. But because I cannot trust the results of one viewer, because I already gave you the statistical evaluation of that is much lower than if I pull them all together and pool their collective effort and their collective perspectives, then I am able to gather a really highly usable and a highly valuable percentage of data.
I should point out we're going to play the audio from that Proof Positive segment you mentioned, which was a really good demonstration of what you can do with remote viewing and what the trackable results were. It was deemed proof positive. In other words, you proved the validity of the science of remote viewing.
Yeah, I mean, there will be plenty of skeptics that will chime in and say that, yes, well, you know, but it's always, there's actually a condition that that skeptics will apply to it that says that individuals have a tendency to develop patterns from random chaos. Of course, if you're a skeptic and you're part of 2% of the population of this planet that believes in nothing beyond the physical, even though you believe in something, which is that there is nothing beyond the physical, which is what they often fail to accept, they will then try to justify their perspective from the realm of science, which is, it is not justifiable. It is not justifiable to step back and say that it doesn't exist only because it cannot fall within the interpretation parameters that I establish as a skeptic. What a real skeptic would say is they understand that everything is highly interpreted. When you're doing the Sci-Fi Channel's Proof Positive, and all they can do is match what viewers are sketching up with what is supposed to be seen in the target. When all they can do is match what viewers are producing with what is supposed to be produced in the target, well, that is the best you can do in that. And if what is sketched and what is verbally extracted from the target by the viewers is in fact present in the target gestalt, then there isn't any way to get around that. It's either there or it's not there. And if it's there, then they should be given credit for what they produce. And in this case, they were given credit for what they produced. They had a police sergeant from the California Highway Patrol who was there not so much to explore this as a potential for law enforcement, but he was there to make sure that everything was on the up and up and that nobody was slipping information to people. I mean, they didn't say that on the show, but that's really what the California Highway Patrol sergeant was there for, was to make sure that everything was, you know, as it was supposed to be, and that people weren't bringing in photographs and other things and showing them to the viewers, saying, here, sketch this, and, you know, this will be good. It was done wonderfully pure and very clean and following a scientific protocol to develop this and bring the information in, and then to be evaluated very cleanly to say, here's what they sketched. Is that there? Yes, it is. So, again, we weren't looking at burnt tortillas and seeing, you know, the Eiffel Tower in a pattern on a burnt tortilla, but that's what, I guess, somebody from a skeptic perspective would assign to this interpretation, but that certainly wasn't the case. If somebody draws stacked pancakes, you know, and calls it a building that's stacked up, that's round and has layers like this, and right on the route that this beacon was riding on is Capitol Records, well, you know, that's not just coincidence. It's there because that's what they saw and that's what they detected and decoded into this two-dimensional representation of that.
And it was such a good illustration of viewers working together as well, the sketch of the roof coming separately of that building and then putting sketches from other viewers together. But I think, you know, I think they did a really great job on the show, and it was really fun getting to be a part of that adventure with you.
Yeah, that was. It was really great. And there'll be more. You know, that's what's so interesting about this phenomenon. What's so interesting about this is the manner in which it's applied is that when you look at the human condition, because 98% of the population of this planet believes in something beyond the physical, they call it by many names, but 98% of the population simply believes that there is something beyond the physical. What's really cool about looking at this is when there is a credible display of what is possible within the human condition, that there is this extraordinary promise and possibility within each of us, that it's like starting a backfire, you know? once one program does it and it proves positive and successful, then the next program steps in and wants to do it. And the next one steps in and wants to do it. And what's really interesting for the listeners is that they don't each one come in with, oh, well, let's really tighten it down so that we can really get to a place where we can prove that it isn't real. What they're all interested in is the fact that they can set a set of standards in place, and they can say, here's our scientific experiment. We're going to say, here, and if this is here, and if we can go to a group of independents and say, if this is what they produced and this is what they were supposed to see, do you draw a line in parallel between those two and say they did or they didn't do it? And that was what's so great about having, you know, this police sergeant and the director and the production team and everybody else in both of these programs that we did, was that you had independent analysis of this, individuals looking at it from a neutral perspective, not trying to grind a skeptical axe and say, hey, I'm going to set up my test, and if you pass my standards, then I'll give you, the little gold star and say you are what you say you are. Because if you ever take that on, of course, that will never be accomplished. But here was a group of independent individuals watching this and looking at it and evaluating it and came to absolute conclusions that we did, or that the viewers did, exactly what the viewers said they could do. And because of that, then again, because of it now, this is igniting a fire of possibility and promise in the human condition. That means that others want to keep doing it. Now these other shows keep coming on because they want to have a part of this. They want to have a part of showing this world what is really possible in each human being. Not to turn around again, particularly in this day and age, and to step forward with some sort of maniacal glee and say, you see, there really isn't anything to you beyond just the fact that you breathe and eat, which is what a lot of perspectives are out there. These other shows want to come on, like your show, and say, this is what's possible. And look how beautiful it is. And look how significant it is. I mean, all your life you've lived with this belief that there was something beyond the physical, and maybe you put yourself in this place of saying it is, maybe it's just not for me. Maybe because of my conditioning in this existence, I am part of the 74% of that 98% that really believe that the glass of their life, is half empty all the time. Or maybe you would rather be willing to step over into that part of the population, the 24%, that says, the glass of my life is half full, and I'm always looking for ways to fill it more and fill it more and fill it more. And if you keep filling it up, and if you participate in something that is quantifiable and measurable, something that is really powerful, what you're going to find is that you're going to create this place where you're going to be able to step from a belief structure and step cleanly into a knowledge, into a knowing that you are more than the physical. Believing that you are more than the physical, that's an easy thing to do. The problem with a belief structure is that it's conceptual. And if it's conceptual, it's constantly moving and swaying and morphing and changing and spinning. When you step from believing and through an experience in the physical and or the non-physical, what occurs then is you codify that experience into a knowing that you are something more than the physical. When you know you are more than the physical, you're able now to live your life stepping outside the conceptual illusion, outside the interpretation, the opinion, the judgment, the conclusions of others. You're able now to walk freely with an understanding that you are, on some level, the unconscious level, this omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, eternal being. That's a very powerful, empowered condition and state in which to be, particularly in these times.
Well, as you know, David, since the first time I first interviewed you, which I think was, about 4 years ago, I think, now.
Yeah, it was about that long. Yeah.
And I don't like to just conceptualize anything. I went down and experienced your courses and can't say enough about suggesting that for other people who really want to know and really want to find a way that can be experienced, as you say, that's consistent and documented and science-based protocol. I mean, it's an amazing opportunity. I know I sort of diverted our conversational direction here. I want to pick it up where we left off at. We've got to take a quick break. If you just tuned in, this is News for the Soul, and we're talking with former CIA remote viewer Dr. David Morehouse. This is being simulcast on the web. I accidentally hit the button already. But on 8 o'clock, we're going to continue on the web. You go to newsforthesoul.com. Stand by. We're here to the top of the hour with Dr. David Morehouse. Don't go away. Thank you. for the Soul, Life-Changing Talk Radio, from the uplifting to the annex that we haven't covered yet, is how this information came out from the CIA program.
When one participates in this, and from this place of believing to knowing, then what begins to happen is one begins to question their calling, their election, their purpose, their mythology in this life. You can step out of it fully recognizing its potential and how it might benefit the whole of the human condition to bring about a positive transformation. If you're looking at the whole of the human condition, if you're looking at the evolution of the global society and where we're going and what we're doing, it's really clear to recognize that belief structures have played a pivotal role in undermining, fragmenting, dissecting, destroying a great deal of what goes on in this global societal effort in the human condition. Believing is one thing, but when belief structures take on a power all their own, which now allows them to become a consumer of human energy, a consumer of human soul and spirit, a consumer of and a destructor within the global societal evolution, well, then you really have to question the purpose and indeed the sanity of that particular belief structure. And you find that anywhere you look. Look left or right. Look at whatever goes on, just look at it, and it's there, and you can see if there is, you know, if there's some degree of devastation going on in this human existence. If you follow it back far enough, you'll find that it's anchored well and squarely within some sort of a belief structure somewhere. So, as you step out of this unit, then, as I did, because I was a special operations infantryman, I was recruited into this program and only spent 3 years there because it was my choice to step out of it. It was my choice to step out of it because I was supposed to go to Command and General Staff College, and because that was delayed a year, then I left the unit, and from after leaving unit, was recruited into another organization, another special access program, codenamed Torn Image, which was actually, by and large, the most bizarre thing it ever belonged to, but that's a whole other story. But when I left the unit, I mean, there was this constant nagging question that was there, which was, if you've been part of something that can benefit the whole of the human condition in some positive way, if it can benefit scientific research and development, if it can benefit in medicine or law enforcement or business or you know, whatever the case may be, if this was an intelligence espionage asset, then could it have some application outside that could be a positive thrust in the human condition? Or should I just simply step away from this and say, well, I did sign a secrecy oath, and never look back and say, well, that was a part of my life, and it was an experience, and it was an experience beyond the physical, and it took me through the conduit into the unconscious to a point that I know that those conduits could never close again, and that I know that I have had, for the last 3 years, an opportunity to no longer just experience minor perturbations into the unconscious, but rather have experienced within the last 3 years this opportunity to stand in two worlds. And so doing, standing in two worlds, and being in two worlds, how has that transformed me? How has that shifted me? And can I ever go back and ignore potential of what this could be in my life? And should I have a willingness to share it or teach it? Well, for me, clearly, the answer to that was, of course, you have to. I mean, how can you step back and say that what you've learned and what you participated in, and as real as it is, ought to be simply now sequestered away in the bowels of the Defense Intelligence Agency, never to be brought out for anyone to experience? Now, some of my former colleagues were stepping out and were trying to present it as like a club, or trying to present it as some sort of a novel pastime, but in order to really bring it forward, it needed to have the credibility of its origins. It needed to have the credibility of where it came from, what it was being used for, and why it was so powerful and so significant. And if that could be brought forward, then it would really serve as a positive influence. If you just brought it out and made it another board game or card game, then it would only carry that degree of power behind it, and it would really not ever amount to anything significant within the human condition. It would drive nothing anywhere. So with that decision, I violated a secrecy oath, and I told the story about what I was involved in. And in so doing, of course, I suffered the repercussions of being an 18-year career military officer, making that decision to do that. And it is not a welcome reception when one chooses to do that. But that's not anything we need to talk about. Where we need to be at this point is, what are we doing with it now? So once that decision was made to bring that out, then I began teaching law enforcement personnel for a very long period of time, and then a number of people started asking if we would teach it outside of the context of law enforcement. And I was really very opposed to that, and I was opposed to it for a number of reasons. One, I really didn't believe at that juncture in my life that individuals outside these other professional endeavors could ever really appreciate what it is that we were doing there and what it is that we were willing to make the sacrifices of career, of potentially lives, of the lot members of our families and so forth, to come out and tell this story about what we were involved in. In fact, it's interesting, you know Theron and Marianne, that Theron and Marianne went through this training with me back in 1998, and it was at the Omega Institute, and they were there in 98, and we were just laughing the other night at dinner as we were getting ready to leave Vancouver, because they were just talking about this very clear mental perspective that came from very much still being attached to the military as I came into that. It was like being in remote viewing boot camp, they were saying, and we were laughing about that, because it's not like that at all now. And I said, well, you know, you have to understand my perspective at that time. My perspective at that time was that anybody that's here is only here out of some bizarre curiosity. They really don't understand the significance of what it is that we're bringing to them, or what it is we're telling them, or how we're telling them. So I really kind of went kicking and screaming into the world of training at that juncture what I would have called civilians to be capable of doing this, because I didn't think they would ever really appreciate it. Well, of course, that's now 15,500 plus students have come and gone through coordinate remote viewing classes. It doesn't even include what's gone on to extended remote viewing, what's gone on to master extended remote viewing, what's gone on to explorer class. That then pushes the envelope well above 20,000, what keeps moving through. And it's just, you know, it's an enormous undertaking to teach it, but a tremendously rewarding experience to bring that knowledge to anyone who steps up and says that they would like to taste it, that they would like to experience it.
You know what we need to talk about at this point, because we haven't really explained to them what it is.
Well, of course, what remote viewing is, according to the Department of Defense, is that it is the learned ability, implying then that it is an inherent ability within each person, that it is a learned ability to transcend space and time, to view persons, places, or things remote in space and time, and to gather important intelligence information on the same. Again, not a metaphysical perspective, something born rather in a bed of science, tested, developed, perfected as much as it could have been perfected at Stanford Research Institute International in Palo Alto, California, and then brought out into the military intelligence community. The way it is taught by me and explained by me to you when you're learning it is that don't get yourself lost in this whole idea of the learned ability to transcend space and time. That sounds really sexy, but if you're stepping back and really trying to develop some sort of a human understanding of what that means, then it really asks you to accept a lot without having any knowledge of exactly how that occurs. So the way you're trained in coordinate remote viewing to understand that is to explore the physics of the metaphysics from it, and to really understand how you detect and decode data constantly. There are two kinesthetic activities associated with coordinate remote viewing. Now, if you're listening to this and hearing it for the first time, don't let this explanation strike fear in you, because it is a very simple process that I'll explain to you how you do it constantly every day. It is part of your nature to be capable of doing it. But this lexicon applied to it has a tendency to be somewhat overbearing, but if you'll bear with me on it, you'll get it. What remote viewing really is this ability to apply two kinesthetic activities associated with the process. They are detecting and decoding. Detecting essentially means finding, right? Decoding means interpreting whatever it is that you found into a usable media. So now let's carry this explanation further. What a remote viewer does is detect four-dimensional waveform data. Now, it's actually eight-dimensional hyperspace or beyond, but that's beyond the context of this particular radio show. But that's what you find out in the Explorer class. So we go into that explanation of that and how it is and what it works when you get well embedded into your training. But it is four dimensions referring to three dimensions of space and one of time. You detect four-dimensional waveform data, which is relevant to a target distant in space and time. You decode that into coherent three-dimensional thought form, which is further objectified by sketching it or writing it down and decoding the verbal sensory data in the terms of colors, textures, temperatures, sounds, smells, dimensionals, energetics, aesthetics, emotionals, tangibles, intangibles, etc. So let's go through that again. You detect four-dimensional waveform data relevant to a target distant in space-time. You decode that into coherent three-dimensional thought form via whatever modality of perception you have, whether you are a tactile perceiver, a digital perceiver, an auditory perceiver, a visual perceiver, Those are four principal modalities of perception, or you may have gustatory and olfactory, or combinations of all of the above thrown into that process. But you are detecting the four-dimensional waveform data, decoding it into coherent three-dimensional thought form, which is then objectified. Objectified means taking it from what's going on in your mind and write it down. It means write down the colors you are perceiving, the sounds, the taste, the smells you are perceiving. It means sketching in two dimension, the textures, the dimension, the contour of whatever it is that you are seeing in your mind's eye, if you will, to use that expression, mind's eye. So that sounds maybe like it's complex, but if all the listeners understand what's happening to them right now, we are transmitting a radio signal which is moving through four dimensions of space-time. It's moving through three dimensions of space and one of time. And it's moving all throughout, wherever it is, unless it's, of course, it's the webcast, but it's moving through the broadcast tower, invisible to the naked eye. This waveform is moving. It's being picked up by an instrument, the instrument being your radio, which is then taking that signal, detecting the signal, decoding the signal electronically into another signal, which is being broadcast out of a set of speakers. So now that signal is now coming in waveform again, from electronic waveform, now in a different kind of a waveform, now in a sound waveform, still invisible to the naked eye. It is moving across three dimensions of space and one dimension of time, and you are hearing it in the radio broadcast through these instruments you call ears, which we all call ears, and those instruments are detecting that waveform data. They are decoding it into an electrochemical signal, which your biological brain is now decoding into coherent three-dimensional thought form you call language. And if you speak English, you understand that language. It is coherent three-dimensional thought form. And if you were taking notes from this program, you are objectifying into two-dimensional media what it is you are interpreting. And that is what hearing is. So the hearing is actually taking place in the brain. It is detecting four-dimensional waveform data in the form of sound waves, decoding it into coherent three-dimensional thought form, and if you're writing it down, then it is objectifying it into two-dimensional media. The difference is that a remote viewer is doing this to a target distant in space-time. Now, if you jump into quantum physics, if you get into the whole concept of the non-local domain, if you jump really into all of that world, you'll understand more about what I'm talking about, and it's not really something that an hour radio show can cover, but everything is energy, and energy is everything, and therefore everything is expressed in waveform on some level. So the world around you only appears to be solid in the quantum understanding of this. It is not solid at all. There are no definable edges. Everything exists in this 99.9% space that we all are, and everything exists not in particle form, not as matter, but it exists as energy. It exists in waveform. So the ability to detect and decode something, as we say, distant in space-time, is really not distant at all. It is in this holographic matrix field, this Akashic record, this global mind, this collective unconscious, this realm of the unmanifested, as Wayne would say, this non-local domain, as Deepak would say. All of that is where you are detecting and decoding the data. So it's simply a matter of moving through that process. Coordinate remote viewing is simply a protocol that teaches you through a disciplined structure, the ability to detect and decode that data, to objectify it into two-dimensional media. So it's not a complicated process, but it is a very deliberate process, and you're taught that, and you're taught that through my lectures, you're taught that through practical exercises, you're taught that through now with the use of additional trainers that have been trained by me for thousands of hours who are present there to be with you to help explain and help you understand this whole process and protocol. And you will do it. I mean, there out of nearly 16,000 students through CRV now, there have been only two failures, both of which are self-imposed. These are individuals who step out at the end of the first day and go, this isn't for me. So they had some other idea, some other intention before they stepped into the class. But two out of nearly 16,000 is a fairly good statistical average. Yeah, I would say that there's not an educational institution on the planet that could tout that kind of statistical ability.
It sounds so complicated at first, but I'll tell you, it's amazing how natural remote viewing feels to me now. You know, I mean, it does
sound complicated. I know, and it sounds complicated to a lot of people when they're stepping into it. But
it's so different from anything that we're taught.
Yeah.
So you really have to, you feel like this whole process of getting your brain to go, okay, I can accept this, I think. And it can, because it's all, you know, based in a science-based protocol. Stand by for a minute. We're going to switch over to the webcast, newsforthesoul.com. The fun's going to continue.
And now you get this shamanic perspective of what is there in an etheric form in these particular power places. So it's a really powerful experience, an amazing experience. You know, as practical as I am about those kinds of things, I will tell you that I personally witnessed those lights above the horizon. The steps were 6 feet high. You know, they were like, they were just huge. They weren't human steps. It was some sort of a ceremonial site, which looked very much like it had to be a site, or could have been a site, where something came and landed there.
Explain. Back after a little bit of a hiatus in an adventure in Peru, we're back, and he's with me here today, the person we were in Peru with, Dr. David Morehouse, former CIA remote viewer, and we're going to be talking about what happened in Peru. Welcome back, David.
Hi. It's good to be here.
Isn't it, though?
Yeah.
At this point, it's good to be anywhere. So it was good to be in Peru. What an adventure. I'm not even sure where to start, but how about at the beginning of why remote viewers were in Peru?
Well, it's an annual trip that we make, and the reason we go there primarily is because we're trying to offer kind of an extraordinary experience for both novice remote viewers all the way up to the advanced remote viewers, many of whom were there were very advanced, and of course we had a few people who this was their, they had done the home study course with us, or they, some of them had just taken the basic course. But the idea is to take remote viewers there to go to this really wonderful, magical, beautiful country of Peru, and various sets of circumstances, from temple work to actually standing on the ground of sacred sites. And the intention in being there is for a collective experience as well as the individual experience, but primarily for this collective experience, for viewers to go there, to be together in these places, and for us to remote view these sacred sites, you know, to open ourselves by doing these various initiations and sacred ceremonies at these sacred temples, and then to remote view a particular power place or sacred site, and to carry into that particular place as we stand there physically this non-physical awareness of what it is that we perceive there, this beyond the surfaces, if you will, experience of being from a viewing perspective. That gives you this, you know, you go into it, and we give you the old archaeological perspective, which says, you know, here's what we know about the Incan times, and, you know, maybe a new archaeological perspective, if one exists for that particular site, which says, here's what we know about Incan times, and here's what we know about pre-Incan times, and what may have existed here. Then you have this collective remote viewing experience, you know, using focus questions to try to answer specific things. And then you have Jorge Delgado, who is, you know, the shaman which goes with us, and now you get this shamanic perspective of what is there in an etheric form in these particular power places. So it's a really powerful experience, an amazing experience. And now the 2 years that we've done it, it's just been, I mean, you just can't ask for a better group of people. You just can't ask for a more focused and dynamic and purposeful, committed, loving and compassionate gathering of people that are there in these places, all pulling together to master this collective and as well as individual experience. And you were there.
Oh, God, yes, I was there.
There you came out of Vancouver down at sea level where you were and stepped into 12,500 feet. That's the first time I saw you when you showed up there.
Yes, I
walking
whooshed
quite
front.
Slowly and lightheaded.
Very slowly.
Camera in hand.
3 steps at a time. I was looking at the footage, and you can hear me wheezing up the hill to catch up with you guys.
Well, you just put music to it.
Yeah. very loud music. You know, that's the thing is it was, see, we sort of idealize the spiritual aspect of these sites and, ooh, Machu Picchu, you know. It's a real spiritual warrior trek, almost, really.
Yeah, it really is. And but again, you know, I can't say it enough. You see the pictures of places like Machu Picchu. You see the places of pictures of like Ollantaytambo, Tambo, Silistani, Wiracocha Temple, the Monkey Temple, the Moon Temple, the Sun Temple, the all of these things that are Huayna Picchu, you know, and the different islands that we went to that see to visit the Oro people to, you know, and even to Chiricahua. I think I didn't say that correctly. I never do. But to make that trek that we made, which is 60 kilometers and, you know, increases of anywhere from 6,000 to 7,000 feet in elevation, it was an amazing journey and a journey that which normally is not made by such a diverse group. I mean, we had all ages, we had all sizes, we had all levels of experience of backpackers and, you know, hikers, and then...
Yep, you're talking about Chiricahua.
Chiricahua.
Yeah. Chiricahua, the new Machu Picchu site.
Yeah, which, you know, it's so little of it yet excavated, but and so difficult to get to that not many people go. I mean, not many people. What this group experienced was something that, again, not many people have an opportunity to see because no group the size of our group goes there. And usually the groups that go there are smaller groups of two or three or four experienced backpackers.
Mm-hmm. I was researching on the Internet today, actually, about it, and a recent article that was posted had quoted something to the effect of, you know, less than 100 people this century have set foot on that site. Well, 120 now or so after our group. It was a significant jump in the number, you know, that they had recorded. So
yeah, and again, all age groups, all experience levels, all sizes, all, I mean, that was what was so amazing about it. And if it hadn't been this kind of a group with these kinds of people, I just don't think it would have ever happened. I mean, the guides were quite amazed, and so were the wranglers that handled the mule team that carried our supplies and other kinds of things were just, and talking to Jorge later, they were just all amazed that this group pulled together, took care of each other, and made it through that entire, that entire journey, that expedition to go see this place. And even though time was limited for us once we were there, we still had time to go there and have this sacred ceremony and initiation and time to meditate and be there, even though it was only a couple of hours as opposed to a half a day or a whole day, you know, next
mm-hmm.
time.
Well, I think once we all figured out where we were going and how hard the trek was, I think we were all amazed that we made it, actually. So it's not something that people should be taking lightly. I want to stress that. But it was worth the trek for various reasons. But before we get into that part of the trip, and kind of unveil what happened there and what we found there. Getting back to how you're saying about how we went into these sacred sites, these thousands of year old sacred sites, and not just seeing them, but feeling them and kind of remote viewing into them.
Yeah.
Was quite profound. And a lot of us had, you know, a lot of profound moments in there.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the big validation of that, of how profound it is, watching this man born and raised there, Jorge Luis Delgado, to watch him, this shaman, to watch his responses to what remote viewers are producing. That's really most of the fun of it for me, is not only watching what happens for the viewers and seeing what, you know, occurs for them and how excited they are about what they found and how confirming it is for them, especially as they walk the ground that they were remote viewing hours earlier, or when they are remote viewing on the ground in which they're standing but being asked to look beyond the surfaces as remote viewers. What's best for me, just as a remote viewing teacher, is watching just the excitement in this shaman saying, yes, that's what we know. Yes, oh my God, yes, you know, that's what we know. And, oh yes, you answered this question and you came up with this piece of information. And he did that so often, and he feels so connected to these people who come from all walks of life and all over the world to be here as part of this group, who then, you know, open to this understanding that just for him is a big validation for him and for a validation for his life's work and the things that he has been taught throughout his life, which is why he does so much stuff for you guys in terms of not simply giving a demonstration of a ceremony, but really performing an initiation and a rite of passage and preparing you for new levels of understanding. That's his commitment to the remote viewers that are there, as opposed to just you know, walking there and having an opportunity to listen to a shaman give his perspective, right? You get to participate in this pulling back of this gossamer veil separating two worlds. That's a powerful journey.
So how is it that you came to choose working with Jorge, and does he have an understanding of what remote viewing is?
Yeah, he has a really good understanding. The first year we were there, we went with the intention of teaching a class there. So Jorge sat in on the class, and again, it was just a validation and a confirmation for him of what it is that he felt he already knew and was capable of doing. He's been at this for many years, since as a young child, his training as a shaman began around the age of 11. But how I happened upon Jorge, or there came a meeting between the two of us, was really because of Theron and Marianne Mayall, who had been going to Peru for many years now, and they developed a friendship with Jorge. And this friendship with Jorge really became a triad between Don Miguel Ruiz and Jorge Delgado and me, and we just shared ideas and concepts about what could be done, what should be done, and Jorge has begun preparing this book, which Don Miguel is endorsing and or writing the foreword for, and which I am endorsing, and it is a book, a story of his journey, his progression, his learning. And when remote viewing was introduced to him by Theron and Marianne Mayall, the kind of the coordinators for these journeys, these two journeys we've made, he just opened immediately to it and was really excited about it. And then when he saw what the remote viewers were able to produce last year and this year, then his excitement level just continues to increase exponentially, because it's opening to so much more possibility for him. I mean, he really sees remote viewers as a tool with which to increase his awareness, to open new pieces of understanding, to provide data that is not otherwise available except through shamanic tradition, I mean, through shamanic tale and lore and sharing of stories. I mean, they're sharing stories about etheric flames and the colors of a flame, and then in the blind, viewers will go in and look at this thing and come back with the presence of a flame and the color of the flame, which validates what the shamanic legends have been. So it's not that one replaces the other, it's just that they begin to augment and complement one another, and that's what he really loves about it, as well as do I.
So when we were going, I mean, it was a marathon of sacred site after sacred site. I mean, there's so many there, and we probably only saw a smidge of what's really there, but many of us were experiencing things that were beyond words, you know, and I noticed that you were there participating right along with us in these ceremonies, and some of them seemed pretty moving for you as well. Do you want to share a couple of what those experiences were, that more moving, profound experiences?
I mean, mostly what happens when I come there, I mean, sure, I'd love to share with you. Most of what happens when I get there is I make it really clear to the participants that my job in being there as a remote viewing teacher is not to be there necessarily to each time participate in all of the ceremonies with you. My job is to be a videographer and a photographer along with other individuals, because we really try to keep it. We want to make a really great video record of the experience and turn that into a DVD, which we give to all the participants, and a really great photographic record of that, which we give to all the participants. And so often when you're in the circles and you're doing the other things and doing that work, you know, there's a guy running around the outside doing the video and the photos and stuff like that, which is usually me. Occasionally another member of the group, but we're trying to get that group experience and cohesion put together there. But in one particular place, most people recognize that I see that as my calling in this particular place, is not to be the teacher. The teacher is Jorge, and I am there to be just the leader of this expedition and to really serve in a kind of a practical role. But Theron walked over to me at this place called the Monkey Temple, which is where the Heart Rock is, and as one of this temple where we were doing this preparatory work, all of us were there, and Theron came to me and said very quietly, "Why don't you just turn the camera off, and why don't you just be in this place, because it's a really special place?" And of course, I'm kind of looking at him like, "What do you mean, turn the camera off? The camera has to be rolling, you know." But he just reaches up gently and takes the camera from me, and you know, turns the camera off, and I lie down on this, just in the grass, in the ground of this particular place, and I am just suddenly so overwhelmed with love and compassion and just enveloped by the spirit and the energy of this place that tears begin to just pour from my eyes, just uncontrollably.
And then in just being there in maybe 20, 30 minutes in this ground, I just felt so much a part of and connected to something that was so amazing. And it happened so quickly that it was something that every human being ought to experience once in their life, just this unconditional love from this Pachamama, from the earth itself, from this connection to the earth, the inner world, the present world, the upper world, the cosmos itself, this authentic aspect of oneself being there on that ground. And then to be able to go forward to the heart rock and to embrace the heart rock with Jorge behind you, preparing and initiating and uttering the incantations as you are there, these ancient thousands of years, these words have been spoken at this particular place. Again, there is this experience that is just overwhelming, this connection at a level beyond, that really just defies language, that I experienced there. I mean, and that was just one place, and we went through so many.
So many, and it was so profound. Like that. It's true. It's beyond words.
Yeah, three days at, 3 weeks at basically attending either two or three particular sacred places per day.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty full plate. I mean, people were exhausted. We were getting people up, and we were up and out and on to to the temple work at early in the morning. So we were there by 8 o'clock, and 8 or 9 o'clock doing the work, and then from there to the next place, and from there to the next place, and back home again at 7 and 8 o'clock at night, and people getting a little sleep, and then back at it again the next day.
Well, that and also dealing with the realities of traveling to Peru, the altitude sickness, and other potential health problems.
That which you alone experienced.
Oh, God. Flat out on the Lima, Peru airport floor. Yes, I did.
You have to make sure that when you're going there, you're going to a developing country, and it's just a matter of, that's why we start, we were starting high and working our way down from there. We wanted to start high up at Lake Titicaca at the highest altitude, and it takes you a couple of days to get acclimated, and then from there, if you're in moderate physical conditioning, it's a couple of days to get 2-3 days to get acclimated, and from there, if you'll notice, we had a plan and we had a system. We gradually increased the lengths of the walks. We gradually increased the severity of the inclines, and declines in the walks. We had a whole program and a plan for how we did it.
Yes, which would have worked out excellently if it weren't for the fact that I arrived 5 days late.
Yeah, you missed all the acclimation.
I did. But, it was worth the wheezing because, wow, one of the sites and ceremonies that seemed to be really profound besides the monkey temple was the sunrise ceremony at Machu Picchu.
Yeah, that's always a really powerful one. And then to go flying on the Condor Rock to do the sunrise ceremony there is very profound.
It's again beyond words. Like I couldn't understand why we were all feeling so emotional.
And it's also something you don't see happening there. I mean, when you look around, when you're there, it's this group that's doing these kinds of things. The vast majority, you look around this thing, and it is, there are lots of people coming there to say that they have seen and stood there on the ground of Machu Picchu, but there are not many, if any, other people. I have, in 2 years' time, at least in the days that I have been there, I have not witnessed, not once, any other gathering of people to conduct ceremonies and initiations. And that's not to say it's not that it doesn't occur, and I'm sure that there are some listeners that have probably seen or participated in those kinds of things. But in the time that I have been there, now 2 years in a row, I have not witnessed that. But this group is always doing that. First up there in the morning, there before the sun has even come up, and they're in position to receive their instruction, and then you are in this powerful place where for millennia, human beings or more have stood on this very same ground, in this very same preparation, with these sharing and connecting to the ritual of these thoughts throughout millennia, this energetic representation of all life that have stood there to watch the sun come up through these over this particular place in the mountains to watch the rays of sun crawl down from the mountaintops until they finally touch your face and embrace and envelop your body again. And there again, there's not a dry eye in the house, because it's just the experience and the connection of those who have come before that have been in this place. It was amazing just to look around and to see every person with tears streaming down their face simply from the preparation and then the being in this place, this ancient place, and in this ceremony as old as time itself. Oh, it was amazing.
It was, and it was really powerful for everybody there. I mean, my mind was thinking, you know, what's the big deal? It's a sun. You see it every day. Hello. You know, like you say, it's beyond words. It's feeling this history and the intention behind the exercise and experiencing it in a whole different way.
Right. The stones, you know, the walls, the ground, it all speaks. I mean, it's there. It's what a remote viewer lives for, is that seeing beyond the surfaces, seeing and feeling beyond the surfaces. It's what anyone with a spiritual quest in their life seeks, which is that ability to connect beyond the surfaces of things, beyond just what the physical can see or touch or feel, but to really feel, if you will, into the quantum level, into the energetic level, because at that level there are no definable edges, which means that the history of that place continues there in this energetic level. And being there, being present there, connects you to that, and your whole body feels that, and your soul feels that, and your mind connects to the mind of those who have come before for the 20 and, you know, 10 and 20 and 30,000 years before in this particular place. And as everyone there knows, even Jorge knows, it's like, you know, the reign of the Inca, which was, you know, 500 to 1,000 years, that was a minor remnant reign of these particular places. These things were assembled, built, put there, lived there, you know, blessed and created and existed for millennia beyond the Inca, for millennia. And to be a part of that and share that, if only for the time it takes for the sun to rise up over the mountain, then that is a magical time of one's life that can never be fully explained only in language.
Has to be experienced personally, firsthand, really, to get it. So, do you want to explain to them what the condor flying was?
Well, and we'll send some pictures, and they'll be posted on the web so that you can see them, the listeners can see them there. There's a particular rock that's there that's called Condor, the Condor Rock, and most people don't know what that rock is for, but the way in which the rock is shaped as a place where you sit, and it is shaped to fit a human spine, and so you sit on this rock and lie back on the rock, and your head then is extended backwards over the rock, and you're looking thousands of feet down. I mean, you're not actually, I mean, if you were to fall off of the rock, which you wouldn't, you'd fall about 30 feet or so, but, I mean, from ledge to ledge, the sensation is that you are now upside down looking through the valley around Machu Picchu, upside down. And of course, as you know, that we had the condor feathers and the Andean eagle feathers all put together in ceremonial handles, so that each person, when they were on the rock for their time on the rock, were holding the condor feathers. And it was a place where you were, in Incan and pre-Incan times, a place where a human could, in that position, then link with the visual reference of flight, as if one were a condor. And you have this sense then of being this powerful spiritual power animal soaring above this sacred place. And, you know, that's after the sunrise ceremony that is there. And then there's also another place where you are taken, where you're shown where you can kneel or stand on this other particular rock and close your eyes and feel through your heart and through your mind's eye the sense of what Machu Picchu is, and what's really significant about it, besides just the grandeur and the beauty of the construction and its location, but really the energy of the place, being able to stop looking and to begin experiencing and feeling, rather than thinking about what it is that is there.
Feeling what it is, that's exactly what it is. And I have to thank you for prodding me on to do that condor flying. Because I probably would have pulled the I'm filming card to get out of it. Those of us with height issues, it's a bit challenging to see the leaves to be dangling over, you know, thousands of feet of valley. But
yeah, when people see the pictures, they'll get the reference for it. When they see it, they'll be like, I don't blame Nicole for not having wanted to do that. But, you know, you have all these guys that are there. You know, you had Troy and me and others and all, you know, all these guys that will help you into position. And, of course, Jorge right there talking to you, holding your feet. I know that doesn't sound comforting the way I'm describing it.
No, when Jorge, holding your feet dangle while you're over dangling. The cliff, you know. You pretty much lost them there. But, no.
But you know, the other one where right next to the doorway, the portal to where, if you'll remember,
Emmamuru or something?
Jorge was holding Omar by the belt. He was testing Omar, the strength of Omar's belt, so that Jorge could sit there and hold him by the back of the belt while Omar leans out over, you know, several hundred feet of a cliff and opens his arms and closes his eyes to fly in his mind's eye like the condor to soar through the valley, kind of in this very present lucid dream or viewing, if you will. But it's just kind of funny to see some of the practical stuff. So, you know, how strong is your belt before I do this?
It was quite funny because that was actually when I just finally wheezed my way to the top of the hill to catch up with the group. That's what was happening. And I remember standing there looking on in horror thinking, oh, God, do we all have to do that?
So Jorge was, oh, no, we'll all fly when we get you to Machu Picchu.
Exactly. But happy we did. Boy, it's the thing. It's you know, we'll be posting footage and photos up soon, and you can kind of get a better idea of what we're talking about on newsforthesoul.com, actually on lifechangingtv.com as well. But it's a feeling thing. It's not like going there and just seeing, just looking. Like you're saying, all these other tourists were kind of there, but not seeing or feeling what we were feeling, not having the same experience.
But marveling at the experience we were having. I mean, and even in the resonant chambers and other things at places, you had people from other groups trying to kind of like just stand next to this group because of the energy and the love of this group. People wanted to be next to it. They were drawn to it. They felt it. It wasn't what was being said. It was what they were feeling again in this place that they were being drawn to. Because what was being said was, you know, if you're really looking just for a litany of information, you'd be better off to buy the guidebook and pay one of the approved, stamped, sealed, you know, authorized Machu Picchu guides to drag you all over the site and say, well, this was this and that was that and this was this and that's that. But to be part of a group that experiences the site from an energetic level, a cellular level, a viewer level, a dissolve yourself into the site itself level, then you wanted to be with this group because that's what people who were, you know, people who had a spiritual connection and even beyond that were drawn into it. And you know, again, you go back into this really diverse group, you had people from all walks of life, from people in the business world and VP of Sony Music and, you know, and guys from, you know, from the contractor, operative, you know, security world to mothers to, I mean, retired people. You had everyone. It wasn't just a bunch of spiritual guru-focused kind of people that were there. It was people from everywhere, and all people in that group began to be connected and to feel and sense and understand the significance of what it is that they were involved in. And that's so powerful for me to see that happen. It's the big gift to me is to watch just the faces and feel the heart and the tears and see the smiles and the successes and the growth that take place in the people who make that journey. Do the things that they might otherwise say, I could never do that.
I want to come back and talk about that last week, the trek to Chuquicamata, what we found there, and what was profound about that trip. Intrepid trek that culminated into a four-day hike. Well, it was a lot more than a hike. Into Chuquicamata being billed as the new Machu Picchu site, and it's quite the ride getting in there. But, you know, we found something interesting, didn't we, David?
Yeah.
Oh, you did. You were quite excited.
Oh, about the top?
The top. Tell them about the top, David.
When we were up at the very top, there, some of us arrived because, you know, we had walkers, and then we had some folks who were riding and other things.
And then you had the people like me who were limping in.
Yes. We kept the people riding the horses to the rear just in case we had any medical emergencies and, you know, that kind of stuff. So the hikers arrived first, and so as the hikers came in, we had just about 2 hours of sunlight left, and so there were four of us that continued on, as exhausted as everyone was, continued on the half hour, 35 minute from the base camp on up to the site itself. And once up on the site itself, we're looking around at the site, moving around. We were the only ones up there. We were taking pictures. It was just an amazing, amazing thing. And it was, you know, getting ready to watch the sun go down in this gorgeous valley of tremendous magnitude, just watching that go down. But there was a point from where this site was that just had a stairway that went down over and then a small path that went up. And it was very much an integral part of the site. It was kind of like looking at Huayna Picchu, which is attached to Machu Picchu. But this particular site at Choqquequirau, you look at it, and it is just this mountain, which is probably 75 meters in diameter, but the whole top of it is just chopped off perfectly flat. And it's chopped off perfectly flat, and it's near perfectly round, and it has a wonderful, you know, pre-Incan wall built around this thing. So the four of us look at it. We look at it, and the first thing that comes to our mind is, that's like a landing zone. And we're thinking, the two of us that are ex-military guys, we're thinking like, well, that's a landing zone for, like, helicopters. Then we kind of snicker, and it's like, yeah, but there weren't any helicopters at that point. So, nor now up there at that height. So this is not a helicopter landing zone. This was a pad, because when you go up there, there's nothing there but just this ground. And so somebody from the group said, well, it could have been a playing field of some sort. And we're thinking, looking around going, right, that would like be having a tennis court up here, you know. How many, whatever it is that you thought you were playing with, do you think you would knock over the wall, which was only 3 feet high, and then it would drop down 2,000 feet, and you'd have, of course, run down to pick the ball up and come back up again. So just jokingly, that was an just not probable that it was a playing field of sorts. It was some sort of a ceremonial site, which looked very much like it had to be a site, or could have been a site, where something came and landed there. Now, that's where I left that at that point, and that's where Troy and Nancy and Rebecca and I, we looked at it and we went, yep, could have been a landing site. Really kind of looks like it could be a landing site, and don't really know what else it could possibly be. There were no ruins, no foundations. There was nothing on it except this mountain with the top cut off perfectly level, or seemingly so, near perfectly round, 75 meters in diameter, maybe 100 meters in diameter, but about a 3-foot wall, 1 meter high wall all the way around it, and a stairway up to it, or pathway up to it, and very much a part of Choqquequirau. I mean, within 100 meters within from the main structures of Choqquequirau. There were also some other interesting aspects of Choqquequirau. There was a particular place between two of the main structures that there was a place where there were steps, but the steps were enormous steps. The steps were 6 feet high. You know, they were just huge. They weren't human steps, but there were on the sides little human steps. Now, when you first look at something like that from an archaeological perspective, you're saying, well, it could have simply have been architectural, and that's true. It could have simply been architectural. It certainly wasn't agricultural, which is kind of an oddity when you're looking at things there. You're looking at it and saying, well, it's not agricultural because these were not terraces where they were planting and growing. This was a narrow set of stairways, kind of like what you would see in the Sun Temple and other places in Copan and other places in Mexico, where you see the Sun Temple, these large square pyramids with a set of aligned steps going up to the center. The difference being that the lined set of steps going up through the center from the bottom to the top were 6 feet tall. The steps were 6 feet tall. So the rise of the steps, the rise and the landing of the steps were equally, they were like 6 feet, then 9 feet, six up, 9 feet back, six up, 9 feet back. But then there were little people steps put in to the left and the right-hand sides of this so that human beings seem to be capable of. You could walk up it, and then you would have to traverse across the big step and go up the next set of, you know, four steps and traverse across, and the next set of four steps and traverse across again to get yourself to the top. So I took a picture of it. So we were then, like, just in our mind kind of putting these things together, all of us kind of smiling and saying, okay, we're not drawing a conclusion here. We're just throwing out a possibility that we have a landing strip, and then we have some sort of steps here that are built for things that are definitely not, I mean, standard human size. And if you're looking at most Incans or Incan descendants, they're shorter than we are. They're all well under 6 feet and pushing mostly around 5 feet. Most of the women are under 5 feet. Most of the men are between 5 feet, 5 inches tall, 5 feet, 6 inches tall. So this was just an unusual set of stairs and an unusual platform to be a part of this site. And this site, they estimate, what, they're saying 13 to 15% of the site is at this juncture excavated, and the rest of it is, I mean, there's so much of it that they're still just trying to restore and excavate and restore.
It covers the entire mountain.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere.
Right down to the bottom.
Everywhere you look. Right on up to the glacier, which is, you know, the glaciers, which are not very far above us, as you well know, having huffed and puffed up the mountain, that the glaciers and the snow-capped mountains are right there. But then here we are all standing in this particular place, looking at it, marveling at just the structure and why, asking ourselves why these kinds of conditions are existing. Just amazing. I mean, how do you describe it?
I don't know how we really get this across without people experiencing it and seeing it, because it's beyond words. Again, you're feeling into these sites, and this was, I wish we had more time at that last site, because, well, I didn't know about the steps. Definitely send me the picture about the steps. Just amazing energy was coming off that site.
Oh, yeah, you have to see the steps. You looked at those things and went, yeah, these. I'm looking at a set of them right now. It was just that you just went, yep, nah, these were not people steps.
I mean, as a remote viewer, what are you sensing beyond the surface of those larger steps?
Well, again, it would be something that what I sense and what I view would be two different things. So I didn't make it a target, and I haven't looked at it. I may do that in the future, but I didn't at that time. So all I can say, when I looked at it, just from being from a scientific, practical, archaeological perspective, I looked at it and I had no understanding of why steps would be like that unless the steps were there for just an architectural perspective. And again, that's a possibility. But my gut tells me that I didn't see that anywhere else. I didn't at Machu Picchu or at any of the other sites that we have been to there see that example. That doesn't mean that that's not the case, because you can see a building in downtown San Diego or downtown Vancouver, right, in the city, that you might not see that building anyplace else. It may be architecturally unique. And so I'm not minimizing it. I'm just speaking as a practical and from a scientific perspective, and I'm saying that I did not see that example, that architectural example, anywhere else in 2 years of journeying there. So to have seen it there in that place, and then to have seen this bizarre large pad at that altitude, just having the top of a mountain neatly removed, and it was quite a bit. I mean, if you followed the line of the mountain up, and when I give you this picture, you know, you can draw a line, and if you see what was removed, where there again, most of the time that wasn't done. I mean, that's the whole beauty of most of the structures there, is that they are pinned and neatly laid into the creases and the crevices and, you know, terracing and the directly perpendicular to the fall line of this of these particular mountains, which are quite steep. It's odd to see a place where suddenly the entire top of the mountain is removed, you know, just gone. And if you follow it up, it means several hundred feet of this particular point of the mountain were removed. It's not the whole mountain itself, but I mean it's a point of the mountain. It's a piece that comes out and forms its own small mountain top, which was removed to leave 75-meter to 100-meter diameter pad that was up there, which is where we went to have our sunrise ceremony at that particular place, at Choka Kirao. And then I know that in the bottom base camp, before we began the 6,000-foot climb up out of the river valley to the mountain pass, there were amazing displays and dances of lights that were there that not just one or two people saw, but that, you know, 20 to 25 people saw and watched happening and watched flashing and dancing and rolling and spinning. And, you know, there were some people who were trying to say, well, there's a campsite up that direction. But, you know, there was no campsite up that direction. And
well, not only that, but at some points those lights were above the
Yeah, they were above the horizon and the tree line. And I will, as practical and, you know, as practical as I am about those kinds of things, I will tell you that I personally witnessed those lights above the horizon.
That just shot
past?
Yep. Yeah, there. Yeah,
yep.
There.
See it? There's about three of them, and they get a lot bigger than that.
Oh, I see it now.
It was so bright before. Must have been closer or stronger.
This is what we were watching last night for hours, but this one that we just saw got really big. There's like about three of them.
It's got a reddish hue to it now.
Oh, kill
them. They're moving.
Check them off.
Check them off.
Woo! Whoa! Oh, God, I hope I'm getting this on film. There's two.
They're not real. I don't know what they are.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.